Walk into any newsroom today and you'll find headlines about Iraq's sectarian violence, Syria's civil war, or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Turn back the clock a century and you'd find none of these countries existed. Between 1914 and 1922, European politicians sitting in London and Paris drew lines on maps, creating nations from scratch in a region they barely understood. These weren't careful decisions born from deep knowledge, they were hasty improvisations made during wartime chaos. The borders they drew, the kings they installed, the promises they made and broke, all of it happened in less than a decade. Yet we're still living with the consequences. Picture a luxury yacht gliding through the Mediterranean in 1912. On board, British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith and a young Winston Churchill tour ancient ruins, marveling at vanished civilizations. Churchill complains jealously that the Greeks and Romans only said everything first. The irony is thick. These men can't imagine their own empire might someday join those ruins. At this moment, the Middle East barely registers in European consciousness. The Ottoman Empire, which has ruled the region for centuries, seems like a sleepy backwater. The countries we know today, Israel, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, don't exist. Most Europeans couldn't locate Damascus on a map and didn't care to try. Yet beneath this surface calm, everything is about to explode. Within 2 years, Europe will plunge into a catastrophic war that will destroy 4 empires, including the Ottoman one. That collapse will create a vacuum, and European powers will rush to fill it, not with careful planning, but with desperate improvisation. For over a century, Britain played what Rudyard Kipling called the Great Game, a strategic contest with Russia stretching from Constantinople to the Himalayas. Britain didn't want to control the Middle East, they just couldn't let Russia have it. The Ottoman Empire and Persia served as buffers protecting the route to India, Britain's crown jewel. This created a paradox where liberal politicians in London condemned Ottoman atrocities while British officers from Cairo to Calcutta propped up those same regimes. By 1914, the Ottoman Empire was less a functioning state than a historical accident still breathing. Founded by Turkish horsemen in the 13th century, it had once ruled 30 to 50 million people across 20 nationalities from the Persian Gulf to the Danube. But the Ottomans had mastered conquest, not governance. When military expansion stopped, they had no economic engine to sustain themselves. Outside major cities, the Sultan's authority was fiction. The government collected only 5% of taxes directly, while local sheikhs and brigands held real power. The Young Turks, who seized power in 1908, faced systematic territorial losses. Their contradictory response, embracing European technology while rejecting foreign ownership, left the empire desperately underdeveloped by 1914. Camel caravans crawled at 2 miles per hour, while foreign-owned railroads moved 10 times faster at one-tenth the cost. Between May and July 1914, the Young Turks desperately sought European protection from France, Russia, and Germany. All rejected them. When war erupted and Germany reconsidered, they seized the offer. Churchill mobilized Britain's fleet without cabinet permission when World War I began. His next move proved catastrophic. 2 powerful battleships were being built in British shipyards for the Ottoman Navy, funded by patriotic public subscription. The Sultan Osman I mounted more heavy guns than any previous battleship. Churchill saw these dreadnought-class vessels as vital for Britain's narrow naval advantage over Germany. Despite Foreign Office warnings that seizure would be illegal, Churchill ordered both ships detained on July 31, 1914. This decision humiliated the Young Turks, who had staked national prestige on these vessels, pushing them definitively toward Germany. Churchill's grab for naval advantage had inadvertently driven the Ottoman Empire into Germany's arms, ensuring the Middle East would become a major war theater. Churchill's next gamble nearly redeemed his earlier mistake, and its failure haunted him for life. In early 1915, he proposed forcing the Dardanelles Strait with warships alone, reaching Constantinople and knocking the Ottoman Empire out of the war. every military authority insisted this required a combined naval-army operation, but War Minister Kitchener refused troops while demanding a naval-only attack, a contradiction that doomed the plan from the start. What happened next was extraordinary. After a naval battle on March 18th, Admiral de Robecq ordered retreat. What he didn't know, Turkish commanders had simultaneously concluded their cause was lost and ordered forces to fire remaining ammunition and abandon positions. Had de Robecq pressed one more day, he would have faced no opposition. For Churchill, this near miss became lifelong torment. At dawn on April 25, British and Dominion troops waded ashore at Gallipoli. The Allies held overwhelming superiority that first day, but Turkish reinforcements soon eliminated any chance of quick victory. General Hamilton dug in rather than re-embark, dooming the expedition to trench warfare. The battle lasted 259 days and ended in Allied retreat, with each side suffering 250,000 casualties. A supposedly backward Asian army had defeated a modern European one. Lord Kitchener drowned at sea just as Emir Hussein of Mecca proclaimed rebellion against the Ottoman Empire. Hussein had preferred neutrality, collecting bribes from both sides, until discovering the Young Turks planned to depose him. When Ottoman forces executed Arab dissidents in Damascus, many connected to his son Faisal, and 3,500 troops marched through the Hejaz in April 1916, Hussein was forced to act. The revolt fell dramatically short. The Arab Bureau had anticipated up to 250,000 Ottoman troops of Arab origin would defect. None did. Hussein commanded only a few thousand subsidized tribesmen, ineffective against Turkish artillery. British official David Hogarth dismissed them as guerrillas, not of good quality, who would not attack nor withstand Turkish regulars. Britain invested £11 million, equivalent to about $400 million today, with little to show. Hussein's followers never captured Medina throughout the entire war. By September 1918, British officials worried about making Hussein look successful to prevent Britain from looking bad, a telling admission of the revolt's actual impact. The 1917 Balfour Declaration, promising British support for a Jewish national home in Palestine, transformed American Zionism. Louis Brandeis addressed Jewish Americans' core concern that Zionism might question their patriotism by reframing it as enhancing American identity, comparing it to Irish Americans supporting Irish independence. The declaration became an Allied war goal endorsed by President Wilson. Zionist Federation membership surged from 12,000 to 175,000 by 1919, though Zionists remained a minority among American Jews until the 1940s. By 1922, Colonial Secretary Churchill had redesigned the former Ottoman Empire's Arabic-speaking territories. He combined Kurdish, Sunni, Shiite, and Jewish populations into Iraq under an Arabian prince, nominally independent but effectively a British protectorate. Syria and Lebanon went to France. A new Arab entity that would become Jordan was carved from Palestine, while the area west of the Jordan would contain the Jewish national home. Churchill's March 1921 Cairo conference focused on cutting costs. He slashed Middle Eastern expenditures by 75%, from £45 million to £11 million annually. He installed the Hashemite family as local rulers, believing pressure on one Arab sphere could achieve British ends across multiple kingdoms economically. The modern Middle East emerged when European powers dismantled Turkish rule, creating countries, installing rulers, and drawing borders, but never securing local acceptance. This sparked enduring conflicts over not just rulers or frontiers, but the very existence of countries like Iraq, Israel, Jordan, and Lebanon. Deeper still is whether European-style secular states can survive in a region governed for over a millennium by holy law. European statesmen underestimated Islam's resilience, failing to foresee religious movements' continued vitality. This explains the region's characteristic lack of legitimacy, no shared agreement on rules or recognition of countries and rulers. The deepest irony, the 1922 settlement was obsolete at implementation. It embodied 1915-1917 thinking, but British views had evolved dramatically by 1922. They regretted giving France Syria, installing ineffective Hashemites, and accepting a mandate for a Zionist program they'd abandoned. British officials would govern without conviction, having imposed a settlement they no longer believed in. They created countries from map lines, installed kings without popular support, made incompatible promises to multiple groups, and drew borders sensible in London, but not on the ground. A century later, we're still living with the consequences, a region where borders, governments, and state legitimacy itself remain contested.